You're listening to the Montreal Entrepreneur Podcast. Each episode features interviews with successful local business owners, CEOs, and coaches. Discover how great businesses are built, learn how their systems and processes work behind the scenes, and see how you can replicate their success. Now here's your host, Kathy Bernard.
All right, so Luciano, once again, thank you for being on the show. It's a pleasure to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks, Kathy.
All right, we have a lot of interesting topics to talk about today. And without further ado, let's jump right in. Right now, I think you're the managing director of Cushman & Wakefield. Can you tell us a little bit, what do you do exactly?
Sure. So by profession, I'm a real estate broker. I've been a broker now 20 years. And over the last 3.5 years, I've been running Cushman & Wakefield here in Quebec. So my responsibility is the Quebec market and the Quebec geography, all service lines combined, but more specifically, the brokerage service line. So, you know, typically I'm overseeing the work of our brokers who are doing transaction of assets in the either retail, industrial, or office domain, either on the leasing side or on the selling side.
Okay. And how big is your team?
Our team is about, we're about 50 people here in the province of Quebec, and then we've got over 50,000 people at Cushman & Wakefield across the globe. So I always count them as part of our team because these are all people that we tap into on a regular basis for different things to either help our clients here or to help our clients across the world that want to do business in Quebec.
But at the office where you're at right now downtown, how many are you in that particular office?
We're about 30. So we have two offices in Quebec. We have about 30 in Montreal downtown and then about 20 in Ville-Saint-Laurent, which is our satellite office for the suburban market.
Okay, I understand. And I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit here. what is your favorite part of this job that you're doing right now?
I have a lot of favorite parts, but my favorite part is meeting people. And you know, and I'm smiling because obviously a struggle right now during this pandemic and the confinement that we have. But certainly the interesting people that I meet, both on the investor side of our business, on the occupier side of our business, and of course, the different people that we meet just in the community. I'm always fascinated by people and their stories. And so for me, I think that's my favorite part, is the meeting of people. I think also my second favorite thing is helping young brokers and young professionals elevate their game and help them with their training and just help them kind of get the bug for this business and help them be motivated and stay the course, because it's not an easy business.
That's exactly what I was going to add. It's not easy because it's a separate entity. You have to like make it happen on your own. It's like you're an entrepreneur too, right?
Exactly. So our brokers are entrepreneurs and they share the common platform that I oversee. But I have been a broker myself and I've owned my own brokerage firm with partners in the past. So I absolutely know what it means to wake up every morning hungry and to wake up and know that I need to come home with something at the end of the day or else I'm not going to get paid and I'm not going to, you know. So I think that's so important. I think it's so important to have that hunger and you know, so I appreciate the fact that I'm able to impart that training and that, I guess, that acquired wisdom over the years, share that with my team. And I say junior brokers, but I also, you know, appreciate sharing with my maybe more seasoned brokers, who we're always learning from each other. And that's what I appreciate about being in a business that's very much a relationship business, very much a people business. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And what is your least favorite part of the job?
Least favorite part, I would say, whenever there's conflicts, because for me, I always like to see a win-win situation.
Yes.
I don't think it's a feasible long-term where somebody's winning and someone is losing when it comes to like negotiations and stuff. So I think that in this environment, I do have some issues sometimes where there is a conflict and it has to be resolved. And my way of dealing with that actually has been, and no trade secrets here, but having the two parties talk it out and work it out. And most times it does work out and it works out for the best. So I would say that I would be probably my least favorite.
That's good. So I'm sure that part of the training or the struggle, like you imparted also to the other brokers or the junior brokers that are coming up, because it's something that, of course, that they have to deal with.
Every day they're out there trying to make a living for themselves.
Yes.
and trying to figure out, and they're constantly getting rejected. Actually, our business, we get more no's than yeses.
Yes.
So it's always amazing how do you make money if you're getting more no's than yeses? But of course, that's just the name of the game. You're gonna get 90 people saying no to you before you get 10 people saying yes to you. And of those 10 people that say yes to you, only some of them are gonna be are gonna convert into a relationship and a transaction. So yeah.
It does take a different type of mindset to be able to do this business.
For sure. I mean, and I relate it to any entrepreneur. If you think of, I always used to say, you know, that if you had a convenience store or a dépanneur, if you're running a dépanneur, you know, there are certain things that you have to do for your business and make sure that you have your store is stocked with cold beer, fresh bread, and fresh milk, and so on. And you're running this small business. It's the same thing for a broker. You're running a small business. If you decide that you're dépanneur, you're going to close your dépanneur. Sorry, not close it, but rather you're going to open your dépanneur from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Then you're going to reap the benefits of working from 10 to 4.
Exactly.
And if you're going to be the entrepreneur that says, you know what, my dépanneur is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I'm ready to serve you, then that's a different philosophy. And so I think that that's something that I like to impart with people coming into this business. It really is an entrepreneurship experience, and you've got to act like an entrepreneur.
And how can somebody join your team? How does that happen? Is there an interview process? Do you have a say in that? And what do you look for in somebody?
Yeah. So on the brokerage side, I have a say in it. What I'm looking for in a broker is somebody who has an education, of like a university education, minimum. Yeah, typically, minimum is a university education. Finance background is good. Marketing background is good as well. And then you also have to have, obviously, a license from DOSIC, which is our regulatory body here in Quebec, which allows you to do brokerage transactions. Mm-hmm. And so typically a lot of people that I meet out of universities don't have that accreditation. So they have to go and study for another 6 to 9 months. Sometimes I meet some people that are in the process of doing their exam and getting their accreditation from the OSIC. But typically those are the two main criteria for me, even before looking at a CV.
Okay. But in terms of philosophy, for example, in our company, we try to hire happy people. Like they have to have this thing about them that says, you know what, maybe this person could be more easily trained or something like that. This attitude, positive attitude. Is that something that you look for too?
Certainly love positive attitudes. If you don't have a positive attitude in this business, you're not going to last very long, because you've got to be, you know, I mean, think about right now when the world, I like to say the world, the apocalypse of the grocery store run for toilet paper on March 12th in Quebec, everything looked like it was going to be a disaster. So if you're not positive and you don't have a positive outlook on life, it's going to be very, very challenging to be in this, to be in business. Forget real estate. Mm-hmm. You know, to be an entrepreneur, it's going to be very difficult, especially if, like I said, if you're getting 90 no's out of 100, 90 people telling you no all the time, it gets discouraging. So if you don't have a positive outlook, the other thing I look for in people that want to join us is a trustworthiness. And I know that's not always easy. It's not always easy to test for, and it's not easy to tell. But I look at the CV and I kind of try to understand the pattern. And for me, looking at CV, it gives us a snapshot of what the person has done in the past. But I always like to get into the details of what they did, what they enjoyed, what they didn't enjoy in their career. So, or at least, you know, when it's junior brokers, of course, it's mostly summer jobs that you're looking at. But I always like to understand, you know, how they got the jobs, what they were doing, what they learned. But for me, trustworthiness is the big one. You have to be able to trust the brokers, you know, the people that we're hiring, because, you know, our clients are in their hands, our brand is in their hands, and that's so important. And really, did you ever do business with somebody you didn't trust? Maybe. It was the first and last time you did it.
Exactly.
So, you know, you want to do business with people you trust. And so for me, that's primordial, as they say in French. It's top priority.
Tout à fait. All right. Now we're going to go back a few decades. All right.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Who was Luciano in high school? How would you describe yourself?
Well, I would say I was very extroverted. I was a class representative in grade 7 in secondary 1.
Impressive.
I was one of the first things I did in high school when I walked into my high school is I realized there was no recycling program. And back in the day, around the, I'll just say the mid-80s, okay? Or
yeah.
late 80s, when I started high school, there was no recycling program in the high school. And I approached the principal and I said, look, we need to have a recycling program and I'll take care of it. So I basically wrote a contract with a company that would come and pick up our used paper. And I would collect it every week.
How old were you?
I was, 13. I started in grade 6 in my elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
And then I brought the idea to my high school. So I was, 12, 13, I guess, whatever it is in secondary 1. And so we cut a contract with a company that could come and pick up this used paper. Back then, there was no organized recycling
yes.
in buildings the way you see it today. And I also, you know, basically went against all odds. And when I say against all odds for a 13-year-old, right, it was like when you think of like the barriers that exist in trying to pick up used paper in mm-hmm. a school, you have a janitor who's unionized. You have this whole system that didn't even exist. And so we started this. And I was recognized by the school for this. And then later on, it became popular and it became municipal responsibility and so on. And so not because of me, but just, I think it was just, the times we were there as
okay,
a society,
okay.
we were there.
Ready for it, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm particularly proud of that because it's a story that I'll always talk about. I mean, it was a long time ago. It was over.
But it is impressive, you know, that you took the. But when you say we, like, did you create like a little? I don't know.
No, it was me. It was me actually. It was me at the risk of my friends teasing me and being seen as like a bit of a garbage collector. But for me, that was like someone's garbage is someone else's gold, and there was at the time. There was some value in paper and recycled paper because it would, you know, obviously you'd sell it to a mill and they would
yes.
recycle it, right?
Yes.
And then the paper market went down completely and there was no value in that, which is why a lot of companies weren't doing recycling because unless mm-hmm. the municipality was involved, the fluctuation in the paper market was such that it didn't make sense for you to recycle. So.
Okay. But that's very impressive. So it seems like since you were young, you had this driven mentality for taking the lead into accomplishing something.
Yeah. I mean, look, we can do two things in life, right? We can
yes.
sit there and complain about something
yes. mm-hmm.
or we can sit there and analyze what the situation is and then do something about it. And I'm more of the person that needs to do something about it. And oftentimes I get myself in trouble because sometimes I will maybe take on more than I can handle. But at the end of the day, if you know it's the right thing, then you end up getting it done. And for me, I've always been driven to make change, whether small or big. Yeah, I'm always looking to kind of how do we do things better. For me, in that particular situation, it didn't make sense that we were throwing away all this paper. And there was money in it. So I saw it also from like I'm looking at it from the right perspective, not,
yeah.
you know, not an environmental perspective, absolutely. But I always think that you can make money.
Monetary perspective, yes.
From the monetary perspective. So that's where, that's my MO. That's my MO. And then I became class president or school president in secondary 5. So throughout my high school career, I was very involved in student politics. I was very involved in after-school curricular activities, and I was generally a good student. I excelled in school, not all subjects, but I excelled in school, and I always find it ironic that people that don't like school end up staying there the longest. But anyway, it's certainly something that I find. And then through CEGEP and through university also, I tried to stay involved as much as possible. University was a little tougher. But I'm involved. I'm very involved now, actually, with the McGill alumni. So when
yes,
I graduated
I saw that.
From McGill, yeah. So I'm very. Look, for me, it's about giving back to our community, giving back making a difference in our community. And we're the ones that can make a difference.
It's Of course. But did you find that, was there, sorry to cut you off, but was there was it your parents, your mom or your dad that had this, that instilled that in you, or?
My mom is extremely driven. I think you cannot walk down any street in Montreal where somebody doesn't know my mom. And my mom is not a politician or a known business person, mm-hmm. but she just has met so many people over the years.
Okay.
And she was in the direct sales business. So a bit like, you know, Tupperware or Avon. It was a company It was a company out of Kitchener-Waterloo. It was called Coppercraft, and they would sell copper housewares. And my mom was selling these in home demonstrations at night, and she would, this was her business, and it became so successful for her that she left her day job, do this full time, and she had a team of 30 people selling this housewares by demonstration. So she was very successful, and I saw that. I grew up with that. She would take me sometimes to her demonstrations. So, you know, learning how to public speak and learning how to be in front of crowds. Like, I'm telling you, if you'd met my mom, you'd be like, she's just a dynamite. And I appreciate and I'm grateful for having a mom like that. And a dad, too, who's a lot more conservative, very risk adverse. Two people that were there for me and made sure that, you know, I had not everything. I was going to say everything I needed, but not everything I wanted. But I think that's a good thing. And both immigrant parents they came over from Italy, met here and got married here, and then had my sister and I, but just taught us how to work hard and just be grateful. So
I'm always impressed the impact parents can have on their kids and when after they grow up. It's impressive. Look what, like how your mom, the drive that she had, how she transmit that to you.
She's very driven, and that drive, I think I got that drive from her, and she continues to be driven today.
Of course. It's not something that you lose, I think, you know.
No,
it's part of you. Yeah.
And you know what? And that's another point, Kathy. I think another thing I look for when we're talking to potential employees is that drive factor that I like to call it the eye of the tiger, you know, the Rocky movie of the 1970s. It's the eye of the tiger of wanting to go out there and just getting it done, you know, just do it as Nike says or make it happen.
Yeah, for sure. I totally agree with that. That's one of my philosophy too. Let's see what other question I had. Okay, yes. But I look at your CV, I look at your LinkedIn profile. It seems like you're a very busy man. There's no doubt about that. So how do you juggle life balance? I mean, your personal life aspect, there's the philanthropy that you do. You're very involved in the community and also work. How do you keep it all together?
Well, look, I think I'm not, you know, there are some days that I think that it's overwhelming. I'm not going to lie about it. I think that there's some days where I don't even know where I am or where I need to be. There's going to be some things where I'll miss or they'll fall through the cracks. So I'm very cognizant of that. But I think it's just, and I think you'd have to ask my children, maybe not now, but later on in life, if they see me as somebody who has balanced his life and his work. But one of the rules I've given myself is Friday night to Sunday night, I'm home.
Okay.
And which means if ever there's an event on a Saturday night or on a Sunday night, or, you know, even on a Friday night, then it's got to involve my family or else I'm not there. And I think people understand that and appreciate that. You'll see me at an event four nights a week. This pandemic, I think, has taught me also, my agenda had gone from, you know, let's say 6 to 7 events per day to zero, right? Well, now Zoom calls, but I think that there's a way of balancing. There are days, though, that I'll admit that I'm too all over the place. But you know what? When I start realizing that, it's when I reassess. And I typically do this twice a year. I typically reassess during the holidays break in winter. Yeah. And during the summer vacations, where I look and I look at my calendar and I say, okay, where is it that I'm making a difference, and where is it that I'm not making a difference, and where have I lost the passion, and where have I lost the drive, and where am I still passionate about? And so I've left organizations, not because they're bad or not because I didn't agree with it. Like, it happened that just I wasn't passionate anymore. I didn't have. Or I felt like, you know, I did everything I could. So I did everything I could. So it's time to move on, and it's time to give the space to somebody else. And so you'll see that there's an evolution in my parcours, or in my chemin, as they say in French, you know, like mm-hmm. you'll see that I've moved to other things and other interests, and we evolve as people.
Yes, of course. It keeps life interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, for me personally, I don't think there's such a thing as a balance in everything. I think the concept of having a life balance is it's blown out of proportion, because especially when you have kids, I don't know, it's very complicated.
Hard to be balanced all the time, I think.
I think that's what it comes down to.
But mm-hmm. we as busy people, we as driven people, I think we need to rejig that every once in a while. And like, I like to do it officially twice a year. Mm-hmm. And of course, you think about it every day when you're trying to do something.
That's very good what you do there. You had the reassessment there and see where you're at. And I think that's a very good tool. Yes, for sure. We can move on a little bit to the real estate market, because sure. that's your main domain there. What have you noticed because of COVID? What's the current situation right now with the office space?
So in office space, so it's interesting, because if we look at it from a tenant perspective, from a lease, so somebody who has a lease, mm-hmm. I've always said that a lease has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So those tenants that their lease is up, their lease has come to expiring, those tenants are looking at the market right now, and they're trying to reassess what their needs are. Yeah. Some of those tenants are saying, I don't know where this is going to take us. I don't know what the COVID, the post-confinement world is going to look like with COVID still out there and not a vaccine. So I'm probably just going to renew my lease for the next 6 months or a year as a temporary hold, and as a wait and see pattern before we do any drastic changes. What we are seeing from companies that are like at the middle of their lease is that they're saying, well, you know what, maybe we need to sublease some of our space. Maybe we need to maybe get more space, because with the social distancing measures in place, we'll need more space. Some companies are saying we'll have 75% of our workforce still work from home until further notice, and we're going to try a slow reentry.
Okay.
So that's what we're seeing on the office side. Those that are at the beginning of a lease, I think they're in the same kind of predicament. They're just trying to figure out what their next moves are. So the people that are tenants that are the best suited right now are the ones that their lease is up. Yeah. They have that flexibility if they choose to go on a new kind of workplace strategy, you know, that maybe might suit their business.
But when you go into a new lease, let's say I'm a new tenant, is that something, once you sign, that's not something you can renegotiate, right?
So in life, everything's negotiable. But you know, typically, if you've just come off of signing a lease, chances are that you'll have to live with that lease. The two parties that signed the lease are going to have to live with it. But I would never say no to a client, either on the investor side or on the tenant side, to relook at and reexamine a lease. I mean, this is what we're seeing now, especially on the retail side. A lot of companies, because some of their landlords are saying, don't come and talk to me with your lease, right? What they're saying is, okay, fine. We're going to go and do bankruptcy protection, and that'll force you to talk to us about our lease. And so that's what they're doing on the retail side, is they're forcing the hand of the landlords to say, we need to talk, we need to negotiate. I think most landlords on the office side will probably be willing to at least listen. And certainly if a broker is involved, I think help in that process, because we need each other.
Yes.
Tenant needs the landlord needs tenant. So they need each other. And as a landlord, I don't think you wake up in the morning and say, oh, I can't wait to get rid of this tenant, and I want to foreclose on their space and kick them out. Like, the landlord wants to get paid rent. They're in the business of leasing square footage. And tenants, I think, don't wake up in the morning thinking like, you know, I want to get out of this situation. Obviously, willfully, I mean, and of course, it happens. We're in a situation right now where some businesses just won't make it.
Okay.
And they're not going to make it through this pandemic. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. But on the office side, I'm confident that short and medium term, I think we're going to see some changes. Long term, I think people want to be with people.
Yeah.
And right now, this working from home works because we are all home. We're all Zooming, we're all working from home and working on our setup at home. But long term, I think that as people start to go back mm-hmm. into the office space, there's going to be the haves and the have-nots. The haves are going to be the ones in the office that are going to be kind of getting behind the company culture, getting behind the team building and so on. And those that are working from home, I think will feel disconnected with what goes on at work. I mean, I don't know, I just think of anecdotally, like, you know, if there was somebody in this office right now and they were here and I would say to them, you know, why don't, you know, it's 5 o'clock. Why don't we go grab a beer somewhere and just talk about life? If you're working from home, I will never come to approach you and say, why don't we, you know, have a beer? It's got to be planned. Hey, Kathy, come in next week at 5 o'clock and have a beer. So those impromptu meetings that encourage relationships and build relationships are not going to happen if we're all home.
Yeah, you're definitely right. It's true. It's true.
So I believe in the human spirit. One of my friends had said once, he says, you know, we all have kitchens at home, but people still go to the restaurant. And we know we had a study, Cushman & Wakefield did a study of millennials and Gen Zs, mm-hmm. amongst others. But they are the ones that are enjoying working from home the least.
Oh, really?
Yes. And it's I was a surprise. I mean, we were surprised because it's we think that, you know, this is a generation that's plugged in and they've got their phone and everything is organized and ready to go. They're the ones that are having the hardest time because they need that connection. They need the human connection.
So what you're saying is that in the short term, yes, maybe those people working from home and with the office space is going to have an impact. But long term, let's not get ourselves a trick. It will go.
Well, I think that long term is going to be a hybrid. So I think that 5-day work week in a physical place called the office, I think is going to be what was happening before. We just didn't record it, which is the person would come into our office and say, yeah, you know, tomorrow I'm going to be working from home.
Okay.
And you knew that what was really going on was that the cable company was coming in to make an installation or the furniture was being delivered or something was happening at home that they couldn't be in the office. Mm-hmm. I think now it's just going to be acceptable that 1 or 2 days a week, somebody wants to be flexible and remain flexible. I think it'll happen. And I think that's not, you know, it's not a bad thing. I think it's we evolve as a society. So, but when I hear things like the office space is dead, like that's a little alarmist. And I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, because my next question I was going to ask you is, will investors, you know, will they try to diverge their portfolio more into the industrial side? But from what you're saying, it's maybe.
So, I mean, a lot of the bigger REITs and property owners in Quebec and certainly across the country mm-hmm. own various asset classes.
Yes.
So they have a sprinkling of different assets. And I think that right now what we're seeing is the industrial class is probably going to be the one that's going to survive the best out of this confinement because e-commerce fulfillment, because of logistics and distribution, you know, all of those things that are served out of an industrial space. I think of, I don't know if you were ordering groceries online during the pandemic, but or during the confinement, I don't know if you were going in person or you were ordering.
My husband went.
He went. Okay, good. Because I can tell you that we tried it once in our home. I think one time I had to wait like 9 days for my order.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah.
It's very hard to wait 9 days for food, especially if your fridge is empty. And now, are retailers and are they going to perfect that? I think so, because once I did make my way back into the store, I realized that these orders were being fulfilled by basically staff that was running around the grocery store filling the order. Mm-hmm. That is, I can't imagine that that's the most efficient way to do that fulfillment of the order. So no wonder the orders took forever. And mm-hmm. as one of my friends jokingly said, those people that were filling the orders never did groceries for themselves. So,
you know, but the rotten bananas.
Exactly. Well, and you know, and to your point, Kathy, the rotten bananas actually is what makes retail. And what makes grocery retail struggle the most is trying to get you the perfect banana or the perfect tomato on time to your home without it rotting. And that's the struggle, most of these grocery stores. But they'll figure it out, but they're going to need industrial real estate to help them figure that out. And they're going to need some retail real estate to help them figure that out as well. because the fulfillment may have, you know, we may see grocery stores that the grocery store in the front is not so big, but the back end of the grocery store will have like a fulfillment so that these neighborhood grocery stores can be closer to your home. You're not getting rotten bananas and you're getting it quicker, that it's not coming from one location.
Yeah. I think this with this whole pandemic, a lot of people, a lot of businesses will restructure or have a different view on how to do business, you know, in the long term moving forward.
I think so. And technology is going to play a big part. For those of your listeners who are in the Montreal area and in the Quebec area, we've invested a lot of time and effort and money in attracting AI companies to Quebec. And I think AI is going to play a big role in a lot of different things. We think of, you know, what's the biggest challenge right now in the office buildings? It's not so much the office space is certainly one of them. So you have to reduce the number of people that are in on the actual floor of the office. Yeah. And the other big thing is the elevators. You don't want to be touching buttons. You don't want to be touching doors. You don't want to be, if there is a predictive element to your card, your pass card, if we programmed my pass card into the building that told the elevator computer saying, Luciano Diorio goes up to this floor, and that's the only floor you're gonna let him on. Mm-hmm. So I basically don't even have to scan the card. I don't have to touch anything. It'll just be in my pocket. As I walk to the elevator lobby, the elevator will open up and then close the doors and bring me up to the floor I need to go to. So AI, I think, is going to be important.
For sure.
Cash registers, self-checkout, so, you know, more of that, less manipulation of things.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Well, just Amazon with the whole food that they have in the States, that same concept also, walk in and walk out.
Exactly.
I haven't seen it here, though. I don't know if it exists in Canada.
I haven't seen it here, but I've been meaning to go and have a look at it because obviously very, very curious about the concept. And But to me, it makes a lot of sense. And it certainly reduces the time spent in the store, right?
Yeah. But you mean going to look at it, so you do want to go see how it's done.
Oh yeah, I would like to. Yeah, once we get to travel again, I don't know when that would be, but once we get to travel, I'm always curious. Whatever city I visit, because I have the real estate lens all the time. That's the problem with this business, right? Because you're always thinking about our business. It's not something that you go home or you punch out and like. I'm always thinking about. I'm driving by, and oftentimes my head, I'll get whiplash because, you know, looking at a new property for lease or for sale or some new project that's coming up. We're just naturally curious in our business. So,
So that's the way to go. That means that you're very detail oriented when it comes to the business. Yes, it's never turned off.
Absolutely. And to get back to your point about CVs, what I look for in a CV, if there is one spelling mistake, I will not look at the rest of the CV. I promise. And that's a message that I really do want to send out there, because I think over the years, I think people have disregarded that. But it's so important that that piece of paper speaks to you and where you've been in your life. And you're trying to sell yourself. And if there's a spelling mistake, it means that you haven't taken the time to be detailed. And,
details
are very important.
Yeah, for sure. A picture, would that help if somebody put their picture there, or not really?
No, I don't think so. No. I read a book, Malcolm Gladwell, who talks about, he goes totally against what I think, but which is, he says, we actually shouldn't be able to see people. Because we'll make better decisions if we don't see their face. We'll make better decisions. So he looked at the U.S. presidents, and he said, if they just gave a code to each candidate, it would be different. People would elect different people than what they see in person. So I found that interesting as a.
That's true.
I'm not going to pretend to reanalyze his work, but I thought that was it's interesting in terms of. The visual. I'm a visual person. I need to see people. But I don't think on a CV, I think it's probably better that we don't have that.
Okay. Well, I'm sure the people that are listening, if they want to apply with you, they know they have to read that CV 50 times to make sure.
Make sure there's no spelling mistakes, please.
Especially if it's in French, all the accents that you know.
for sure. And but it's the detail, because in our business, a comma that's put in the wrong place in an offer to lease clause could cost millions of dollars to our clients.
Yes.
And so you don't care enough to have a detailed, a properly vetted CV, then I have a hard time thinking that it's going to be that for our clients. And that's,
I agree with you.
I'm tough. I'm sorry. Certain things I feel like they're just, it's just par for the course.
Yes, for sure. Everybody has their things. In January in 2020, you did an interview. You were on the show, Elias Makas. You did the interview with him there on real estate. And then you talked about 5 buildings that were traded in order to increase the value of the properties. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So in January, Elias and I spoke about different office buildings that were traded. They had gone for like record prices. Mm-hmm. The demand for investment properties in Montreal has gone up. I think a lot of that has to do with just lack of good, solid investments across the board. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people from out of province are coming and looking at Quebec as an option. Quebec is seen as a relatively undervalued, safe haven for money, right? Money follows safety and follows and wants to follow growth. And people believe that Montreal is a growth city, and we've seen it in our statistics in terms of office vacancy, in general our employment statistics. Also, people were pretty much almost at full employment in Quebec before this pandemic. So it's just good news. And these buildings that traded back at the end of last year and the beginning of this year are all office towers in the financial core. Mm-hmm. And they were all offices that, basically that the investors have paid top dollar for them with the belief that, these are going to be long-term investments and long-term plays.
Okay, so I remember you mentioned in the interview that it's basically selling those buildings to other investors and then they hold on to them.
Yeah.
Okay. So if I go back to the previous conversation we're having now, but earlier, okay, maybe right now, because I know the value of the buildings is determined by the ratio of occupancy.
Right.
So let's say it goes down in the short term, but in the long term, the investors, I'm sure they're thinking downtown, it's a gold mine. There is no way that it's going to tank. Not even COVID can affect that.
Well, I think that the valuations on buildings are certainly going to change over the short and medium mm-hmm. term. I believe that real estate is all location, 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 right?
Yes.
And I learned that in secondary one, grade 7 geography, where location, location, location was very important. And I think that's, if you have an asset that's well positioned in a good part of the geography that you're in, I think that there's no, you can't lose out. I think that there's still a sense that, we want to be in a downtown core and you want to be close to the action. Look, this pandemic is rewriting some of our rules that we know as normal, right?
Yes.
Normal is not normal. But I believe in long term, I think that anybody who's invested in these properties and they have the financial wherewithal to hold on to them, I think they're going to be good assets to keep.
Well said. I don't know if you wanted to add anything else on the real estate part and COVID.
I think on the retail side, I think we're going to see some changes there. I think we were seeing some changes prior to COVID. The apparel businesses especially were hurting. Fortunately, a lot of those businesses are headquartered in Montreal mm-hmm. on the Canadian side of things. So I think that there's going to be some shifting there. Retail, I think you're going to see probably retail centers are going to be more mixed-use properties. So you'll have like some apparel businesses. You'll have experiential retailers, like an axe, what do you call it? Those axe throwing places or the escape rooms or stuff, stuff that's going to drive people in once we're allowed to congregate.
Yeah,
and then you're going to have a mix of residential on the same sites.
Okay.
and people wanting to be close to the retail experience and be part of that. So I think that's, that'd be my comment on the retail side. I mean, industrial and office, I think we've touched on that. That's what I would say.
Okay. Thank you for adding the part about the retail there. All right. So now we can move on into your involvement in the community and your philanthropist activities. And the article that was written about you, it described you as a philanthropist at heart. I mean, That's a really deep description, I find. And I see that you're part of many foundations, and many of them you're on their board of directors. There was one, though, in particular that struck me. It's because I'm a mother, so I understand, you know, it affected me a little bit. It's the Tina Survivors Neonatal Fundraiser.
Yes.
Can you tell us what event prompted you to create such a beautiful thing?
Sure. So my son was born, so we have two boys. Okay. My second son was born in 2008, extremely premature. He was born at 24 weeks and 5 days gestational. So, you know, typically 40 weeks, you have two children. So, he came very, very prematurely. And he was born at the Royal Vic Hospital back when it was on the mountain. We were at the neonatal section, and I felt that, you know, one of the things was there was a lack of rocking chairs. There was a point where we were able to hold our son, and we wanted to rock him. You know, we want to touch him and rock him, and we were able to do that, because you're not able to do that right away when he's born, because he's on a bunch of tubes and all kinds of things. And so I said, this doesn't make sense. Like, it's one of those doesn't make sense moments, right? Like, just like I had in high school. And it was, why is there not enough rocking chairs? They want us to rock our baby, but there's not enough rocking chairs. Now we're fighting for rocking chairs. So I said, you know what? I'm gonna try to raise some money for rocking chairs. And I got in touch with a family who had their child 10 years before at the Royal Vic, and they were looking for a way to give back. Okay. And they hadn't really, you get busy in life and you're trying to raise a kid, and especially a child that is premature. There's a lot of complications at the beginning. So we ended up meeting, ended up talking about doing a fundraiser. They were on board right away. She ended up bringing on another family with us. So we were three families in the end that had our first fundraiser. And our intention was to raise like $15,000. Okay. And we wanted to do a very no-frills fundraiser. Come and have a cocktail drink. Come and have some hors d'oeuvres. And you know, basically, the more money that goes to the hospital, the better.
Yeah.
We wanted to raise $15,000. We ended up raising almost $50,000 that year. And people were very touched by our story. I mean, my son was on oxygen for almost a year from when his birth. That was sort of something. And we also, you know, he almost died 1 month after his birth. So we really wanted to find a way to thank the hospital. We knew that they were doing miracles every single day in that department. And we knew that they were under-resourced. So since then, we've been organizing this on and off for almost 10 years. It'll be our 10th year this year. Now, of course, because of social distancing, we won't be doing an event, but we're looking at doing a virtual fundraiser or some sort of a campaign. And I don't know if my committee is going to be upset of me revealing this, but I think what we're looking for is we're going to write a letter to all of our donors in the past and our future donors and say, look, you know what, this year we're not having an event, and we know that people are not, some people have lost their jobs and some people are just not in the financial capabilities that they were in the past years. But if you'd like to give, whatever you'd like to give, but feel free to give to the hospital. And if you cannot give, then don't worry about it. Let's see each other next year, and hopefully next year things will be better. So so that's where we are with fundraising for the hospital. But we're very proud because we've made a difference there.
Yes.
In terms of training for the nurses and staff, in terms of equipment, some of the equipment that we bought. So we did training, which is important. We always forget, like, training is so important, and there's not enough investment in training. Equipment, that we have a room that was named after Tiny Survivors. It's a room that is a simulation room, and it's actually now being used for COVID cases as well, like for COVID training. Mm-hmm. So it's actually... I'm very proud of that. So if you go to the Montreal Children's Hospital, you will see a sign over this simulation room that's dedicated to Tiny Survivors, Petit Survivant. So we're very proud of that.
For sure. How did you come up with the name?
My wife and I think we were throwing around some names. And I think with the committee, I think we just said, you know what? They're tiny survivors. They're little survivors. So,
yeah.
And it stuck.
I think it's really good. It has a ring to it. It's really nice. It's a really nice name. Well, that's a very touchy story. But so you made that decision right then and there. You can't find a rocking chair, and you said, you know what? I'm going to do something about it.
Yeah, that's my MO. You know what? You got to figure it out. No one's going to figure it out for you.
Yes.
And I think that's a message to your listeners who are entrepreneurs. Look, entrepreneurship comes from fulfilling a need. There's a need, and you have to ask yourself the question, why wasn't it done? And why isn't it being done? And a lot of times we'll get 1,000 excuses why it's not done. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to find just that one way to get it done. So for me, I think it was just like, doesn't make sense. We're going to do something about it. And today we're, you know, 10 years in, and we've raised, $500,000, I think it is. So all from a little idea of a rocking chair.
I know, because I was reading somewhere, it says that for entrepreneurs, it's best you make decisions when the idea and the feelings, the emotions is there. Because if you say, okay, yes, it's a good idea, but let me think about it some more. And then as the months and days go by, that emotion, that strong emotion you had, it's faded. Then next thing you know, nothing happened.
It's interesting. I used to be involved with the group called Youth Employment Services, and I'm still formally involved with them today. And their mission is to help young entrepreneurs start businesses. And also, they also help Montrealers, find careers and find jobs. And I would do these like courses and these sessions about real estate. But I'd always talk about sort of like kind of the drive, the entrepreneurship drive. And it was always interesting. I would ask the class, what's your idea? And a lot of people were like, I don't want to tell you the secret. Yeah, I don't want somebody to take my idea. And I always found that interesting. I'm like, look, trust me. You know, there's a lot of ideas out there. People don't follow through with them. You've got to follow through. And that, to your point, Kathy, like when you have an idea and you believe in it in your heart of hearts, you got to go for it.
Because it starts right here first. You have to imagine what could it be.
Yeah. Sometimes they're crazy. Sometimes the ideas are crazy for sure. You know, you got to think it through and see it through and see and test it. But you have to be careful on who you get advice from.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of advice that we get from people who are, they're not in a position to give advice. And instead of not giving advice, they actually give you advice, which is terrible. They should just say, I'm not in a position to give you the advice because...
No humility whatsoever to say no.
Yeah. I actually appreciate that about my dad. My dad will often say, like, I'm not in a position to give you advice. And I'd rather that than somebody being negative. No, Kathy, you can't do podcasts. You can't do podcasts, or you can't do real estate. How are you going to make money in real estate?
No, but because we share that same mentality. Because when I started the podcast, I said, you know what? This is something I actually want to do. And then the emotion was strong. And I said, you know what? Let me just approach people. I didn't even have anything yet. I had no equipment, nothing. And I said, oh, do you want to be on my show? And the first person I asked, the person said, yes. I was like, oh, okay, I guess I have a podcast after all. And then that's how it started.
You just have to ask the question, right? Life is about negotiating, right? It's about negotiating. I could have said no. The first person that you interviewed could have said no.
Yes, yes.
It just becomes. And then if you're passionate about something, it'll shine. And I think that's my message to entrepreneurs, is that you have to be passionate about it, and and you've got to work smart, and you've got to work hard for sure. I don't think like work and working hard doesn't get as, no matter how old you are, no matter how long you've been in business, you got to continue working hard, but you got to work smart. And the smart, I think, comes with age, or just at least not so much age, but just the time that you dedicate to a certain thing.
Good advice. Yeah, that can help. Yeah.
That's my two cents on entrepreneurship.
That's your final message for them there.
My final message for entrepreneurs out there listening, for sure.
And a question I had is, how many foundations are you involved in today?
So I'm involved with the Montreal Children's Hospital Foundation, which oversees the Tiny Survivors. Mm-hmm. And then I'm involved I sit on the board of my local Desjardins, Caisse Desjardins, Mercier Est Anjou. I sit on the Governor General's Canadian Leadership Conference Foundation, which is something I've been involved with since 2012. That's sort of what keeps me busy. And then, of course, the McGill Alumni Association. So I'm vice president there right now with the McGill alumni, and very proud to, we have 275,000 alumni across the world. So very proud of that.
Yeah, it's a huge community there.
Yes.
And if somebody wants to reach you, reach out to you, where can they find you?
So I'm on LinkedIn, just my name on LinkedIn. Then I also have an Instagram page. Okay. I also have Facebook. I guess email is probably the best. So it's luciano.diorio without the apostrophe. So D-I-O-R-I-O at cushwake.com.
I'll put that in the link when we edit the video for sure.
Awesome.
I think now this is my final question, hopefully. What's next for you? Maybe next, I don't know, 5 years or so.
Wow, that is a good question. You know what? I think that I have a lot of work to do here. I think that there's a lot of building to do in this company. I think the opportunity in this market in Montreal right now, Montreal is on fire. Yeah. And I think that there's still some room for growing our different service lines. So yeah. I want to see that through. I want to maybe scale back on a couple of my commitments on the philanthropic side and kind of readjust. And also see my kids through their teen years. They're becoming teenagers now. So, helping my kids through that time, I think that's an important time for parents to be to be around. And then just for myself, I think if I can get a half marathon under my belt, that'd be fun to do. It'd just be a fun thing to do. It's just to get some long distance running once we can all run together again.
Well, this seems like very nice goals for the future.
Thank you. Yes.
So it was a pleasure to have you on the show. And who knows, maybe you'll come back another time.
Thanks, Cassie. Appreciate it. Really, really appreciate the invite.
You're listening to the Montreal Entrepreneur Podcast. Each episode features interviews with successful local business owners, CEOs, and coaches. Discover how great businesses are built, learn how their systems and processes work behind the scenes, and see how you can replicate their success.